Welcome to the Tanz im August Podcast. This podcast series is part of the Tanz im August Festival, presented by HAU Hebel am Ufer. This year, it takes place from the 9th to 26th of August in 11 locations in Berlin. Several artists from this year's program have been invited to participate in a conversation. Each episode seeks to offer insights into their creative process, uncovering what's behind the decisions they made and the knowledge they gained along the way. The artists tell listeners about their current and past projects, revealing detailed information about the work that will be presented during Tanz im August. In this episode, Ricardo Carmona, artistic director of the festival, talks with Agata Siniarska. She will present her new work Null and Void on 23rd, 24th and 25th of August at HAU 3.
My name is Agata. I should use also surname Siniarska, but I'm not very fond of this. I would rather like to say that I'm a daughter of Małgorzata. I am working within the field of choreography. And since few years, I am very much attached to what we could call ecological discourses, which maybe later we will have time to talk more what does it mean, not to make a theme out of them or any label for the work, but more as a tool to work through it choreographically. I live in Berlin since some years already. That's my working base and friendship base. I live with my dog since 4 years. Her name is Foka. Yeah, that's maybe all from my side.
Yeah, thank you. So the work that we're going to present in Tanz im August is part of a larger research that you are doing in the last years, and that's called Museum of the Anthropocene. Why did you decide to start this long-term research?
Honestly saying, I don't remember anymore. That would be the shortest answer. But I started to be very triggered by all the connections and relations that are in or within the world, between us, between different species, and the idea of different time scales and space scales. It was also something that I thought it's something that is part of our everyday life, that I don't think about it that much, that I cannot imagine myself within bigger scales. But at the same time, I am affecting also these scales, or these scales also affecting me. And these things are happening simultaneously on small levels, on huge levels. And for me, in a certain moment, was a question, how can I expand my imagination in order to be more situated within these movements? Because I think it's also not about staying in one spot. We are constantly moving. And that's why choreography for me is such a good tool for this, because if we put choreography on the very narrowing or make the definition super simple, we deal with movement, with bodies, with time and space. So exactly what the world, how the world is operating. And then, of course, it's a question, what kind of bodies, what kind of spaces, what kind of times and what kind of movements. So being officially educated as a choreographer, I think I already have this choreographic thinking since some years, or I'm practicing this. I thought that I can contribute to all the ecological discourses from this perspective, that is not only about facts and numbers, but it's also about embodied affects, because we speak also from our moving bodies within time and space.
And that's what you just mentioned now, use the word expand our imagination. What do you mean by that? And how this is also part of your praxis for this research?
Yeah, I could also say that we have a crisis of imagination, but I don't want to bring Max Fischer right now to this. I'm not very fluent in his writing and his theories, but definitely, yes. I think that the world is global and we take lots of privileges from this. We also are affecting all this, but at the same time, we don't think about it. So every decision that we are making, it affects something on a very small scale level of my being, of my surrounding, but at the same time, it makes something way more bigger or way more further. And in order, I think, to really move through the world and also finding your own agency within it, I need to expand my imagination or my bodily thinking and my mind thinking to move through all these connections. And I'm not saying that I got to this point that I know how it is. It's for me still ongoing practice because we are constantly in the movement and the world is constantly changing. And that's also for me a big thing also with this specific performance that I'm working for, Tansy Magus, that of course I need to stop in a certain moment in order to close this specific chapter and say, this is, that is, because I'm also making a performance. So I'm also making a object that I need to share I would like to share with others. But of course, while working, there's so many other connections that immediately goes and reveals itself. And I would love to follow everything, but of course, that's also not possible. So of course, every project opens another one and another one and another one. That's why, like, even working on this specific one, I see how other things from the past, almost like ghosts, are coming back to me. And it's not like a constituted knowledge, but more like kind of traces that suddenly they activate in a completely different colors or in a completely different texture. And that surprises me because the works that I thought that I already finished, they suddenly become so unknown to me and so fascinating to see them once again or to meet them once again from another angle or in another scale, in another movement.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. Yeah, it's super interesting also how in artistic praxis, it's one project leads to the other and things are much more interconnected than one thinks in the beginning. Yeah. Can you tell us a bit more about your current project? So it's called Null and Void and we're going to premiere it in the festival in Hau3. I know that you are still in creation, but maybe you can also share a bit with us where you are and how the research has been doing also.
Yes. So the research comes very strongly from the work that I did last year on ghosts and monsters. And last year I was busy with Museum of Natural Science and how the Museum of Natural Science creates the nature, the pure nature for us. Looking at diorama as an apparatus to expose things or to perform them, I wanted to still stick to this idea and think what could be a war diorama and how this diorama would be created or performed, of course, from human perspective, because I'm a human and I'm doing it, but speaking nearby non-humans. And of course, it is a reaction on the full-scale invasion of Russia on Ukraine, because I'm Polish and also these are our neighbors. And I was in Poland when the invasion started, so I also see the reactions. And what I started to miss is that we don't speak about non-human, other species than humans, that we speak about the numbers of the victims. And I'm not saying that this is not important, but if one species dies, something dies also in our species. So how also to think about different deaths as also part of our deaths, or how our death is a part of the other deaths. So I started to look at the landscape from after military interventions, and not only particularly on a war landscape, how we understand tanks and rockets and soldiers, etc., but also how the landscape is still in the state of war, even though that the humans will sign the paper and say, okay, peace now. This is not happening this way. There is a completely different timing for the landscape to integrate what the war or what any military intervention does, including all the toxification of earth, of soil, and how also this changes the landscape and possibility for many species to live there. So my biggest question, and still is, like, how me as a human body or as a human person, how can I listen to these stories that are there, that are not spoken in the news? how can I speak nearby them or how can I listen nearby them? First of all, not being non-human and at the same time never experiencing the war, because that's also a clear, this is not my experience. I can watch blockbusters, Hollywood blockbusters and think, okay, this is a war. I can read some interviews. I can find the testimonies, but still it's not my experience. So I also am not trying to make it my experience. I'm trying to get nearby this experiencing and think how I can also hold the space for these stories that are not fully given to me because we don't communicate with the same language.
Yeah, thank you. You just said something that kind of stuck in my head. You said something like, when a species gets extinct, something gets extinct in me. Can you explain a bit what you mean by this?
Yes. I think this is also another aspect of looking at all this relationality that I truly believe that we are, all the species, all the lives are interconnected on different levels. And we all create ecosystems. And then if there is a one change in of ecosystem, the whole ecosystem changes. Everything is affected on different scales. So, of course, in a moment when one species extincts, my ecosystem changes, and thus something changes in me. But because my imagination is in such a crisis that I am not considering this death, or I'm not feeling them, I'm not holding them, I'm not noticing them, because the world is huge, because there are different scales, because I'm busy with my own species, etc. So for me, it's also a question how we can rethink our being in the world through interconnectedness, understanding that we are part, or everything is part of us, we are part of everything. And in the moment when something is gone, a part of us is gone as well. So how we can think beyond our skin borders, but how we can really think ourselves as relations rather than beings in the relations. Yeah.
I mean, for the preparation of this talk, I asked you also some references or books that you read during the creation process. And you pointed out a book from Jairus Victor Grove that's called Savage Ecology, War and Geopolitics at the End of the War, where he writes about the current state of the world, but also of the role of Europe in this situation that we are living now. There's one short line in the book that says, the end of the world is never the end of everything. So also taking consideration that we are now facing or in the middle of the sixth mass extinction, I want to ask you if you agree with this statement that he does in the book and also how you see the future.
Yeah, I think, yes, the end of the world is not the end of everything. I think this waiting for apocalypse to come is a total fiction because apocalypse is already here. I just live in the geopolitical zone where it's still safe and comfortable. So maybe this apocalypse is not that tangible for me, like for different parts of the world. And that again comes back to me, the interconnectedness, how the other geopolitical zones are part of these that I am, because I am that my zone affects the other zones and how this can be considered. And not only thinking I'm living here, I'm safe here, I only take care of this part. So definitely, I think that we are in a time of war, in time of apocalypse. And I think I send you also this part when he speaks that the war is not a metaphor. The war is the state. It's a very specific assemblage that is happening here and now. We just have a different positions within this. But well, regarding the future, I am in the moment that I really can't answer even in one percentage of this. I actually had a conversation yesterday a little bit about it when a friend of mine was trying to find a hope in it. And I don't know. I really don't know. From one point, there is so many wonderful movements happening that are changing the world, even if it's 1%. And this is that we need to fight for. But at the same time, if I look at the percentage of CO2 that Pentagon produces in the world, and I had the pleasure to talk for 5 hours with the general of American Army accidentally on the train when he was coming to Europe in order to check the bases of NATO and American soldiers, how they are doing in Lithuania, Poland, and in Romania. And after 5 minutes, it was very clear to me that we are on a different side of the river in terms of our political inclinations. But then nevertheless, so I was trying to ask him questions and listen to his narrative. And for 5 hours, he had a very consistent narrative around this, how every military intervention is for peace and democracy, and it's not about oil, and it's not about extraction. So this belief in him, I thought, oh, I think I live in a certain bubble, believing that the world is different. This is like a mainstream narrative around it, that the war is actually needed because there are bad people, there are terrorists, that the good democracies they need to take care of. And I ask him, I also like ask him kindly, hey, after 45, United States of America didn't win any war, but it was involved in more than 150 military or war interventions in entire world. Aren't you a little bit critical towards this? And he was, yes, yes, of course. And then he stopped and immediately went to talk about China. There was no more possibility to really look at it from different perspective. This is just one narrative that this is, has to be, and the war is going to be there. This was also his word. He said, there will be never a state of peace. The war will always be there. And this conversation was, I think, three weeks ago, and it stayed very strongly in my head. So, and also affect how I think about the future. And I don't think it's a good narrative I can think of when I think about the future. But at the same time, I don't think we should give up. I think we need to insist. That's our job. We need to insist on what we believe in. We need to insist on creating new relations, practicing our listening, noticing, deep noticing, embracing embodied affects, and all this, knowing, not expecting that this will change the world or this will change the future. I don't think we should go there because then we are lost. Let's just stay here and let's insist. Let's insist.
Yeah, totally. For your process of creation, I know that you visit Japan and Hiroshima. Why did you decide to go there? And so we're just talking about war. And of course, this is like the Second World War, and the disaster that happened in Japan is very present still today. And you visit the places. So why did you choose to go there?
Well, Hiroshima is the... I didn't go to Nagasaki, but Hiroshima and Nagasaki are two places where the nuclear weapon was used. So I wanted to see what does it mean, what is this space, what does it mean to stand in the place when the temperature was so high that everything melted. And what is there now, and beyond the museum and the narrative that the museum creates. Yeah, I guess I wanted to sit there for a while. And I was going there in the morning, and I was also going during the night to see what shadows are there or what ghosts are there. And again, because I went to the Museum of History of Hiroshima Disaster, and there was almost nothing about trees as victims, animals, any other species, nothing. Everything was only about humans and how humans were suffered and how many numbers. And yeah, there was nothing even about the intoxication of the soil and what was possible after and how the soil was dealing with this, how the air was dealing with this. No, not really. And again, I missed this story within it. So I thought that really, at least I can sit there and check if that something will whisper to my ears a little bit different narrative than this that is given, like as an official one.
I mean, you said already many times during this talk, your need of listening and also of being silent. But also at the same time, your work uses a lot of voice, right? So this is how sound and silence is important for your creation as an artist.
Mm-hmm. In order to bring the sound to the space, you need to listen to the space. Or I think you need to listen to surrounding. And when you bring the sound, I think you need to also be aware that you are listened. So it's never, I am here. I always need to be here. And my singing teacher always says that there are two ways of learning singing. And one of the major is through the ears, that you need to listen in order to do it. So I guess that's for me one thing that I need to listen first in order to bring the sound. But of course, the more I was also tracing all the stories of different species, mostly animals, for me was very excited to know that they hear completely different world and how much we don't hear. And that's for me super exciting every time when I go with my dog for a walk, that we experience this walk in a completely different way. And I will never find out. I'm trying to see what's her body's reactions and to like try to imagine what that could be. But she gets completely different melody that I am getting. So of course, I will never learn how to listen as a dog, as a chacal, as an eagle, I don't know. Nevertheless, I can still try to listen more, try to listen deep. I can try to listen throughout my full body, even though, of course, that our skin is not that active as a source of listening, because we need specific frequencies that will get to our skin, that we can really hear it through our skins. Yeah, nevertheless, I think, again, it's about insistence of trying to make it deeper and again, even though that it's not about progress. It's not about me getting better in this. I think it's still, maybe it's not even about listening, but I would more open it to awareness, to be aware and aware through different sensorium, different kinesthetic sensorium, through gaze, through listening, through taste, through smelling. I think this is something that we are such a visual culture and from one point it's beautiful, but at the same time, I think we miss also a lot. We miss lots of textures, and I hope that through the work, well, first of all, I am practicing different awareness, but I hope this is also something that I can share with the audience and offer also as a possibility to practice together. And of course, it's just a proposal. It might work for some, it might not, but yes.
Okay, because you're talking about this creating a bigger awareness and also expanding your perception also. But it's a very practical question also. Like, how do you do this, like in a studio, or how you use this to construct the work?
Yeah, thank you for this question. Because especially within this work, with this specific project, the work, it's not only about work from 10 to 6 in the studio and then it's over. I think this work for me, maybe also through the topics and through the stories that it carries, is way more bigger. And of course, I am doing everything for the dramaturgy to be perfect. But that doesn't change the fact that when I am with this material, and it's not only choreographic work in a sense of creating a performance. For me, it's something bigger. And it haunts me. And it also doesn't let me sleep. And it also comes to my dreams. And all these creatures, sometimes I'm coming like a whole horde and they speak so loud. I'm like, go away. I need to sleep. I have a rehearsal tomorrow. But it opens up this project for me a question. What does it mean, like our dedications to work, and in which moment we also need to sometimes a little bit stop it so we can also make the performance happen and not only be completely eaten by this. But at the same time, I think it opens up for me a situation that this work is not a job Of course, I am obliged. There is an agreement. I signed the papers. I'm going to have a premiere on this date. I'm going to do that, etc. But this is not only this. This is, of course, this is economy, and this is another part of the work or interconnectedness. But the work is also somewhere else. And to come back to this question, how I'm actually practicing this, it's more and more difficult for me to work in the studio, because studio somehow closes something for me. So I'm trying to be as much outside as inside. And when I say outside, I don't mean only that I will go to the forest. I think I'm also driven by the ecology that I live in, a city, and how the city also interconnects us. What kind of choreography is there, or choreographies are there? What is the time scale, space scales? What are the species? How we are together? So I'm trying to really look where, like, yeah, even basic things. I'm trying not to listen to music, but I'm trying to attentively walk through the city when I go, and to see how also, how I see, how I smell, how I hear, how my body is within this. Is it aware of the back? Is it aware of the side? Am I only in the frontal? I observe lots of people in the trams. That's also a source of wonderful stories, how also people, what people are carrying with them to the space, and how this affects also space, smaller space of the tram, but then also bigger space of the street, and etc. Yeah, and I'm also trying to, I'm doing also lots of physical practices that make me, or I think they make me more aware of being 360 degrees to be present.
Because you also mentioned and talked also about your relationship with other beings, with animals, with plants, how this is then part of the creation process. So again, like how you do this in a, let's say, practical way also.
Yes, I'm trying to, every time when I encounter any species, I'm trying to think, what is the relation between us, and what are the elements that creates this relation? That is not only me and the tree, but there are other stuff. So that's, for me, fascinating is, for example, looking at the birds, because what makes the birds sing? What is this? Well, is it a throat? Is it a specific note? Is it the wind that also carrying the wave of the sound? Is this also a tree that this bird sits? And also the leaves that gives it a little bit of shade? How all these things we can speak as one, that this is the sound of the bird. And for me, this is fascinating, not to look at particular things, but yeah, everything. It's a car. There is a car. Is this only a car, or the car is, because the car is the road, there is CO2, there is air, etc., etc. So I started to also practice my language, how I can tell this differently, not as a like points in space, but also as a like kind of assemblages. And thus, for me, also looking at the war landscape was very useful, not to think about the bomb that fell on the landscape as something intrusive, but suddenly it becomes a part of landscape. The bomb is a bomb. There's nothing to do who dropped the bomb. The bomb is a metal, is a chemical reaction, and then there's also a hole in the soil, and then there's also a dead body or a piece of dead body, and then intoxicated air, etc. This is everything. So how actually create language this way, to look at the whole assemblage rather than at points? And that's for me also like a practice of noticing and being aware. So I'm trying to tell the stories to myself, noticing as many things as possible. I could be busy with only one landscape, and I guess to tell it again and again and again, because it's changing, and I would, or I'm also changing, so I would also notice other stuff. Sorry, very long answer.
No, thank you. It was fascinating to hear also how you're working around these topics. Yeah. This is to go back to what you sent me with the books and references. So there was a book that was also important for you that's called The General, The Ordinary Man Who Challenged Guantanamo. It was written by Ahmed Errachidi. And in this book, he tells a very beautiful story that when he was in prison in Guantanamo, he developed a relationship between him an ants that were living in his cell, and he was giving them bits of food to feed them. But he also developed like a kind of a code system to warn them when the guards would come so that the ants could hide and not be killed by the guard. Yeah. What was so attractive for you with this story and how you also think about it?
Yes, I also, well, I look at Guantanamo because for me it's another landscape after military intervention. And what started to happen with Guantanamo after 9/11, we all know how many innocent people were also taken as under the umbrella of fighting with terrorism. Mr. Ahmed was one of them. He was 5 years in Guantanamo and 4 years he was in the cell of solitude when even sunlight was not entering. So he was without sunlight and without any voice and any present. And what he literally says that what made him to keep his humanity were non-humans. And that's, I think, one of the most beautiful examples of this relationality, that in order to keep the human, you have to be in relation in non-humans. And here, literally, they just saved him. For 4 years, he was observing them, and he was also mentioning how many different species are within the species, that he started to recognize them, the differences between them. But mostly he was very much fascinated by them, their cooperation, how they give bigger pieces, how they share things, how they organize themselves. And he said that if we would be like ants, that would be a different world. So the lessons also, like what kind of knowledge he gets from these creatures that probably he wouldn't notice in any other circumstances, because who looks at the ants? And that was the only sunlight that he had for 4 years. I think this is the extreme example of how we are connected. And maybe coming back to ecology, because many times I hear, oh, you're busy with ecology, so you're busy with non-humans. I think, no, the being busy with non-humans means being busy with humans, and vice versa. When we're busy with humans, we need to be busy with non-humans. This is impossible. And I think this is something that I really want to learn and continuing practices. How can I be busy with humans through non-humans and not only us as a special species?
Yeah, totally agree, because there's always this false division that often happens, that in one side there's nature, the other side there are the humans, but actually this is all part of one thing and everyone is connected.
Absolutely. That's why, of course, I'm very happy to go to what we call nature. People sometimes say, okay, let's go to nature during the weekend. Yeah, but the nature is us. The nature is everywhere. I think it's a matter of which relations we want to strengthen, which one we want to loosen, and what we want to practice. And of course, to go to the forest is easier to practice certain things than practice them in the city. Nevertheless, the city is a huge challenge, and it's our home. And I think it's worth really to invest how to be in the city differently than we are right now. And yeah, I love cities, I must say. I take also lots of energy and lots of anxiety, but that's also a part of this ecosystem, and this fascinates me.
But for you, why? Because you just said it's a bit more easy to practice certain awareness, certain expansion of sensitivity outside of the city. So, but how do you deal then with this in your creation process? Because you are also in the city creating.
I mean, we live also in a myth of silence, and we believe that when we go to what's so-called nature, we hear the silence. That's not happening anymore. I'm sorry, dear listeners, but we don't have an access to that. I think what we do, sorry that I'm doing we and generalize, but I guess there is a tendency of filter in the city. We filter sounds, we filter vision, we filter experiences, because there are so many, the ecosystem is so dense that it is unbearable for the body. And we do it as a survival mode. But I'm not so sure how much aware I am many times when I do that. So for me, even noticing what I filter or how I start to go into the survival mode, that's already an awareness of being in this ecosystem. So, of course, I like to go somewhere else But I think city is such a conglomerate of also of different technologies that also are part of the soundscapes and the landscapes of our vision, that I think it's interesting also how to practice being together, or how to speak or think all of us. It's not only us humans and then non-humans creatures, meaning living matter. No. I mean, we also, there's lots of anthropogenic materials and objects and machines that we also created. And suddenly they are also a part of this. And they also contribute to the ecosystem. So of course, they need to be also embraced how they are. And I think city is a good example of how to be with this. In density like this, or how not to be, or how it's impossible even to survive this.
Yeah. I mean, there was also a poem that you shared with me that was also important for the creation, or still important for the creation. It's a poem called The Marrow by the writer Ursula Le Guin. I would ask you to read the poem and then we can maybe talk a bit about it, yeah?
Yes, all right. The Marrow. There was a word inside a stone. I tried to pry in it clear. Mallet and chisel, pick and gat, until the stone was dropping blood. But still, I could not hear the word the stone had said. I threw it down beside the road, among 1,000 stones. And as I turned away, it cried, the word aloud within my ear. And the marrow of my bones heard and replied.
Thank you. Why this poem? And why also the connection with Ursula Le Guin?
Ursula Le Guin is nearby since many years. And of course, the love started from the career back, because I find it as a very beautiful idea, again, of this interconnectedness that works within or destabilizes hierarchies, or makes all the time different assemblages rather than the ladder. And I like this example when she talks about superheroes, and the hero who is thrown in the bag is more like a potato, like in a sack, rather than being this superhero that should be on the marble posthumous. And yeah, I don't know her poems that well. This one I got last year. And it stayed with me also in the work last year because of the marrow that can hear, how we can hear, again, how we can hear differently. How is this not about the ears and being impatient with not hearing, but how actually this communication with non-humans has to be established, not on our terms, but it needs to be negotiated, and we need to meet halfway. And maybe we are just using wrong instrumentum from the beginning. I think it's a question how we get into the conversation, not necessarily, I want to converse. And I think this poem is like this, I want to converse with you. And then, of course, nothing happens. So I think it's a question how to, yeah, listen as a guest. So it's also about being a guest. This is a very beautiful book. I don't remember if I sent it to you. It's called Hungry Listeners. And it's about the sound studies, indigenous culture. And this book is written by the person who comes from the indigenous community. And he says it's not that the way how we can meet, because it's not about not meeting, this is our culture and this is our culture and please don't take our culture because it's a cultural appropriation. He said, no, absolutely. We can do it, but you need to be a guest because you come to us in this moment and then we are serving food. And then, of course, we have to find the agreement how we will go through this dinner. But you come to our home. And this, I think, is very also another tool that is for me very, very helpful to think that I am a guest. When I try to be nearby different species, I am a guest. And how can I approach? How can I knock? How can I say hello? Can I enter? Etc. And I think this poem specifically for me holds the different conversation or possibility for conversation or meeting.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I think that's a beautiful note to wrap up our talk. So I want to thank you again for your time. I know you're super busy because you're in the middle of the creation, but it's been a pleasure to work with you. And yeah, I'm looking forward to the premiere.
Yes, me too. Thank you very much for this invitation and for letting me share all this.
Thank you, Agatha.